Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
This week, the 82-year life of professional wrestling legend Bruno Sammartino came to an end. I'm joined on the line by the Wrestling Observer's Dave Meltzer to look back on what is quite an incredible life, and one, Dave, that he had to fight incredibly hard for, and his family had to fight incredibly hard for in the early part of his years. This is a kid, as was, who was sent to a mountaintop to pretty much run away from the Nazis in Italy.
Yeah, when he was 9 years old, the family had to, during World War II, they had to run away for their lives, and they lived in this like refugee place on the top of a mountain for 14 months, and he got very sick during that period, and it was a really harrowing thing that he talked about over and over again. His mother saved his life on a couple of occasions, especially one time when he had rheumatic fever. So, he came to the United States. His family, after the war, wanted to come to the United States, but he was so sickly that they wouldn't let him in until 1950. So it was several years later. And, and then when he started and everything, he was a 84-pound high school kid. And then he discovered weightlifting, and he took to it like incredibly. He loved it, and he loved weightlifting, he loved eating, and he got to be one of the strongest men in the world.
That notion, almost American dream, like, of you can come to America and, make the most of this life that you've been given in the best way that you can possibly do. I mean, when we talk about a guy who is hiding up a mountain away from the Nazis and battling rheumatic fever as a small child and wanting to follow his father, who'd already moved over to work in Pittsburgh, to try and follow them over there and make the best for themselves. It's kind of a story that would hopefully resonate with a lot of people these days.
Yeah, well, I mean, people knew that story in the 60s and the 70s, and that's one of the reasons why he was so popular. I mean, he had the ability through interviews to talk about himself and talk about his life in a very humble but confident manner. He was really, like, people will talk about different things that he did in wrestling, but his ability to connect with the people on his interviews was at a different level from almost anyone. I mean, he wasn't like a Dusty Rhodes or a Ric Flair, people who you think of as being great on interviews and are. I mean, his interviews were very different, but they were every bit as effective as those guys, maybe more. I mean, he had a fantastic track record as a drawing card, one of the biggest in the history of the industry.
Give us a sense of how big a drawing card he was, because there is a talk that, without Bruno Sammartino, there is no New York. I mean, I'm paraphrasing it somewhat, but that's what we ordinarily hear about Sammartino, is that he helped build New York territory under Vince McMahon Sr. and Toots Mont.
Well, without a doubt, he is responsible for the popularity of the championship. Mm. He built that championship in the 60s and made it, basically something that was contrived. Well, they all are, but he made it mean something, and it, remained, meaning something for a long, long time after he left. So that part, I mean, if you take him out of the picture, does Vince McMahon survive the 60s as a promoter? You just don't know. I mean, it's possible that he doesn't. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very possible. I mean, his charisma and everything like that in these cities, when he didn't work on those shows, there's a huge difference in attendance. I mean, the fact that they made the deal that they made with him in 73 to come back as champion tells you, just how valuable he was, because, I mean, he got for the time, it was an incredible deal from a political standpoint to come back, because he didn't really want to come back as champion. He was happy with his schedule at that point, where he was wrestling whenever he wanted and he was home a lot more.
I mean, that first run of as champion, it goes from May 1963 to January 1971. It speaks to the ability of Sammartino to connect to the audience, that for that near 8-year span, it never became old, seemingly. The drawing power, the ability to connect with the audience, I mean, he was constantly obviously working as a fan favorite, a babyface, as you call it, and that never lost its luster, to the degree that, as you say,
He had to be a babyface.
Yeah.
He had to be, because if they had turned him heel, they would have killed their company, legitimately. The people would have stopped watching. I believe that, because, Because I remember when Austin turned and so many fans left. But Bruno, had an even deeper tie to people than Austin. I mean, it wasn't like Hogan where people were booing him and then it was time. I mean, the thing with Bruno is that in that run that you talked about, the eight-year run, he was drawing better at the end than he was at the beginning. I mean, his popularity was still growing, but he wanted out because of his injuries and just wanted to ease up on the schedule. And he drew even better on the second run. And even after he lost the championship, his biggest drawing feud ever was after he lost the championship with Larry Zbyszko, 3 years, roughly 3 years later.
Working in Shea Stadium, I suppose, being the pinnacle of all that in terms of his program with Zbyszko. That connection with the Italian-American audience can't be overstated.
At first, that was his main fan base, but as time went on, and at first he was the Italian champion, but as time went on, he became everyone's champion, and it wasn't an Italian appeal any longer.
Was it a class thing then, Dave?
The guy who everybody was behind Bruno because they saw him year after year vanquish. He was the American hero. He became the American hero as much as yes, he was an icon to the Italian community. But his appeal was so much bigger than that, and grew bigger, really until the end of his career.
When we see that run from 73 to 77, when he's brought back, as you say, kind of against his will, again, he becomes a big draw, and then moves into a bit of commentary work alongside Vince McMahon Jr. And he's kind of in and out of the company up until that point. His son then gets involved, David, then in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s. It's then that things become slightly more fractious in the relationship between Sammartino and the WWF as was. He was a mainstay, and you will know this more than anybody. You were on the Phil Donahue show on a panel alongside Sammartino, alongside Billy Graham, and alongside Vince McMahon during the whole course of the steroids in wrestling problem. He was we talk about people speaking out against the company. There was almost nobody louder than him at the time in speaking out, which is almost incredible to think about the company that he helped make for McMahon's father.
There's a story, and I didn't write it in this week's issue just because I didn't have time, but it came to me this morning that I remember. This was the first time that I remember having a long conversation with him. It was in 1987. He had just quit the company. He was an announcer. He did some wrestling, which he was very unhappy that he did because he felt that by that time he was past his prime, and he so badly from a match very early in his career when he wrestled Gorgeous George, who was past his prime, and people were catcalling Gorgeous George. So he told himself that I will never, once I'm not as good as I should be, I'm getting out. So he got out in 1981, even though he was still one of the biggest draws in the country. And Vince McMahon and David, his son, talked him into coming back because he was still in great shape. He still had appeal. He could still draw. So he came back, but he wasn't what he was, and he felt very bad that he came out and wasn't what he was. So when he retired the second time for good, and then he left the company. His contract was up as an announcer. He left the company. There was a phone conversation where Linda McMahon, when he left, said, "We just want you to know that you can't, you can't be called the living legend. That's the name that, we trademarked the name Living Legend. So now that you're not with us, you can't be called Living Legend." And suffice to say, he was extremely unhappy about that phone call. So, but there were a lot of things. He was very anti-steroid because in 1961, he was in a match with Chick Garibaldi, who in the middle of the match had a heart attack and died. And whether it was due to steroids or not, I remember Bruno believed it was because he was one of the first guys he'd ever heard of that did steroids, and Bruno was a drug-free weightlifter. And so he was always in, feeling that a lot of guys would die because the steroid epidemic got so bad in wrestling. And then as time went on, a lot of guys died.
Yeah.
So he was proven correct. Yes, he had a very bad relationship for years with the company, and then he just kind of let it go and didn't really talk about it. And then Paul Levesque, Triple H, came to him, and actually it was in 2002 when he first called and wanted to bring him in the Hall of Fame, and they talked, and he liked Paul, and Paul made the deal. It was a business deal. He made the deal because of business deal, but one of the things that allowed him to make the deal was that Joseph Maroon, who was his his doctor and a surgeon that worked on him told him that they're really trying to clean up on the drugs. And I remember him talking to me going like, you know, they're not doing the middle fingers. They're cleaning up on the drugs. The stuff that I protested, they're really not doing. So I don't have a reason to say no. I mean, he doesn't have a reason to say yes. It was a business deal. But he felt that, like, he could go back, and he did.
One of the stories that he tells, I think it's on Larry King, in around the late 80s, perhaps, I think it's possibly 89, is he's talking about, and it's one that he often repeated, I think he says it on Donahue as well, he mentions that he didn't want, when he went back with the company and he saw how drug-riddled that it was in the late or mid to late 80s, that he didn't want to be caught in a car with somebody who was perhaps holding steroids or holding some other kind of drug. He didn't want to be associated with people who were using steroids or people who were using, narcotics of a different variety.
There's narcotics as well.
Yeah,
he would only travel with Jay Strongbow.
But it was almost
He didn't want to travel with a lot of the guys because it wasn't his world. He walked, you know, the world that he wrestled in the 60s and 70s, and he was, you know, the big star in that world when he came back in the 80s. You know, it was just a completely different business. It was, you know, everything about the business changed, and it was a party business. And, I mean, guys drank a lot in his day, so I think that, from his viewpoint, I mean, the drinking, I guess, wasn't as bad as the drugs. And, you know, he was so anti-steroids, but, you know, he saw the pills and everything like that too. And,
my point on that is, Dave, is that he almost didn't want to have himself be sullied by the association with people who were using.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't like going on the road at that point in time at all. I mean, but there were other reasons that he didn't, but absolutely. Yes. And he spoke out against it because he was, you know, he was concerned about what it was going, what the ramifications were.
Mm. For a while, obviously, he's on the outs and he does bits and pieces and he speaks out as often as he can against WWE. As you mentioned, the relationship became a little bit better towards the end of his life. Ultimately, wasn't to know that it was to be so close to the end of his life. But he's welcomed back in with open arms. As you mentioned, Triple H, Paul Levesque helps welcome Sammartino back into the WWE family. He's inducted in 2013 into their Hall of Fame by none other than Arnold Schwarzenegger, who again speaks of that great immigrant story of coming to America and making the most of his life from that point on. For me, it just seems like a remarkable turnabout. Do you know what, beyond them cleaning it up, was there a sense that it's time to let bygones be bygones from Sammartino's point of view, and they wanted to brush it aside and just get on with his life and let that bitterness go? Do you know how heavily involved Vince McMahon was in those conversations?
Vince McMahon wasn't involved at all. It was other than the, what happened was Paul Levesque approached him, and Paul Levesque talked about Killer Kowalski, who Bruno greatly respected and who was Paul Levesque's trainer. So they started talking, and they developed a pretty good rapport. When I first heard about it, I thought, you know, he's not gonna do it. But when I talked to him, you know, it was very matter of fact. It's like, you know, Paul's a nice guy. I like him. It's a business deal. You know, if Bruno asked for what he thought was fair, and he thought, you know, there's no way Vince will agree to this. You know, and I thought that to legitimize their Hall of Fame, because without it, it couldn't be legitimate without him in it, because he should have been the first guy in it. But he wasn't because of, you know, the problems from both sides. And when he talked to me about it, it was like, you know, I think that they'll probably agree to that offer. He didn't think they would, but they did. And it was Vince who did agree to the offer. Paul told him, I'll go to Vince, but it was Vince's call. Mm. You know, and Vince did tell Paul at first, you know, why are you even wasting your time? It's never going to happen. But Bruno was open enough to where, okay, I mean, it can happen. And it did.
You published, obviously, or republished the links to a lot of the Bruno interviews from down through the years in the last 48 hours. Dave, what kind of person was he off the record when the mic wasn't rolling?
Well, Bruno was a sweetheart of a guy. You know, I mean, he was very street smart, and you know, he had strong opinions. Was not afraid to voice the opinions. But I mean, I will also say that if he believed that and learned that one of his opinions was wrong, he was very quick to say, I was wrong, I'm sorry. I mean, I know that with my own relationship with him. I had incredible respect for him, just for what he did in life, you know, and he was very humble. I mean, the nicest guy. I mean, he understood that he really drew a lot and was a big star in wrestling, yet at the same time, he was in awe of things like meeting the Pope, just as an example. I mean, like, he would just go, a guy like me who, you know, just a high school education, you know, living in Pittsburgh and got a private audience with the Pope. And I would think it's just like, you know, you're Bruno Sammartino. You're one of the, you know, the biggest, you know, in the 60s. I mean, this guy was a worldwide, in the 60s and 70s, he was a worldwide sports star because, I mean, and you know, he was a hero in Italy. And, you know, he would go in different parts of the world, Australia and Japan, and be a giant star in those places. And, you know, a household name in the Northeast, you know, on every wrestling, you know, if you go to a newsstand in the 60s or the 70s, those wrestling magazines were all over, and Bruno was probably on the cover more than, not even probably, he was on the cover more than anybody of that era because he sold the most magazines. So, yeah, you know, but at other points, it was like he was you know, I remember him. He would always say, like, when he thought when he retired in 1981, he thought, you know, in 2-3 years, everyone will forget me and move on with their lives. And it just astounded him that 35 years later, you know, people would come up to him and talk about their childhood with him, and he was so gracious to him. I mean, you ever read, you know, in the last couple of days, fans. Who are, you know, kids watching him or adults watching him that met him later, and how thankful he was to all of them. You know, it was like people were not disappointed, you know, meeting him later in life. Oh, it's like, oh, you know, and I wasn't either. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, Bruno Sammartino was one of the biggest stars in wrestling. Mm. But I liked him much more, you know, as an adult than as a kid because he was a real guy.
Yeah. Dave, thanks so much for taking time out to take the call.
Okay, thank you very much.
Dave Meltzer there of the Wrestling Observer, and you can read Dave's tribute to Bruno Sammartino on the website there. And now from the squared circle, thank you JP for this one, to the centre circle. Off the Ball is teaming up with Carling Ireland to offer you and four mates an all-expenses-paid trip to a Premier League club for a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to play on a Premier League pitch on Thursday, May the 10th. For your chance to win, visit offtheball.com/Carling. All the details are there. That's offtheball.com/Carling. Terms and conditions, of course, do apply, and you have to be over 18 to enter. And it is all with thanks to Carling, official beer of the Premier League, bringing fans closer to the Premier League action. Always remember to drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie for more information. Alvaro Morata has just missed in the past few moments an absolute sitter for Chelsea, who remain 1-0 up away to Burnley in one of tonight's two Premier League games. The other one is at the King Power and is still scoreless as they approach the hour mark. Leicester 0, Southampton 0. Updates on both of those and a whole lot more in the Football Show with Dan next.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.